Hello and welcome to The Music and the Movies, a program that looks at and listens to the sweet spot where music and movies intersect. In this hour, we ponder the special alchemy that happens when sound meets image, where music lovers and cinephiles come together. We explore a different theme in each episode, arranged around an idea or a person, and we delve into why some of our favorite movie moments are also musical ones. My name is Robert Horton. I'm a movie critic and historian and a member of the National Society of Film Critics. I'll play some music and talk about it in an attempt to get to the bottom of a lifelong fascination with why film is so especially intoxicating when music is involved. And at the end of each show, I'll round things off with the trailer, a particular cut that either didn't fit into the overall flow or has some special meaning to me or just so weird it deserves its own spot. So join us, won't you, for The Music and the Movies. Today's episode, Classical Kubrick. Yeah, here we have a rich subject. How the mighty Stanley Kubrick learned to stop commissioning soundtrack music and love the classics. If you think of some great moments from Stanley Kubrick movies like 2001 A Space Odyssey, Clockwork Orange, or Barry Lyndon, you may well be hearing a piece of classical music that the director decided would fit his vision of the world. Some of these pieces are quite familiar, some are still fairly obscure, I think. And a couple of these have become so associated with Kubrick movies, they're practically owned by those films at this point. We will give a listen to these and talk about how they got into the movies, especially with what happened to the 2001 soundtrack. That's an interesting story. And then for the trailer, at the end of the show, we will hear a piece that qualifies as classical music by a very modern composer. So, by the 1960s, Stanley Kubrick was already a world cinema figure. Born in New York in 1928, he had become a successful still photographer when still a teenager. He worked for national magazines at the time. And he made a couple of short films, made a couple of very low-budget independent features, and sort of willed himself into a successful career. And after breaking new ground with movies such as Lolita and Dr. Strangelove in the early 60s, he set about making a new kind of film, an expensive experimental movie about space travel. He said of 2001 A Space Odyssey that he wanted to make a film that would enter the viewer's consciousness like music, you know, bypass the expectations we have about storytelling and character and all that. And for our purposes on this show, that's a pretty interesting observation about the music and the movies. Well, Kubrick ended up using a collection of pre-existing classical selections for the music of his Outer Space opus, as you know, but that's not how it was planned, much to the annoyance of a veteran Hollywood composer whose commission score was snubbed. I'm going to tell that tangled tale in a minute. But first, we need to kick off the music here with the only way you know we're going to kick off this subject, with music which, before the movie came out in 1968, was known as the fanfare opening of Richard Strauss's also Sprach Zarathustra, to the extent that it was known at all, but which since then has become known, of course, as the theme from 2001. Hear it, and the movie comes back to you, especially the film's opening, as the planets fall into alignment and something mysterious happens with a large black slab. music by Richard Strauss, the opening fanfare known as Sunrise, from also Sprach Zarathustra, a tone poem inspired by the writing of Friedrich Nietzsche, heard there performed by the Vienna Philharmonic, with Herbert von Karajan conducting. Herbie, as I call him. Apparently, when it came to producing the soundtrack album, there's some story about the record label being embarrassed about having the legendary conductor Karajan associated with a science fiction movie, so they wanted the track to be uncredited, and there's a whole tangled story there too. But then later, when the thing took off, that same label started slapping a As Heard in 2001 sticker on their LPs. But you know, Stanley Kubrick owns that music now, because not only does it begin 2001 A Space Odyssey, it's also played at other key points in the film, including the moment when prehistoric man discovers how to use a tool for violence, and also at the inscrutable climax of that film. So it was newly famous after 1968, wormed its way into pop culture. Just a couple years later, Mike Nichols used it for a rather easy joke in his film of Catch-22. There was also this jazzy version by the Brazilian musician Deodato, became a hit in the early 70s, and that made its way into a memorable moment in a movie, part of Peter Sellers' rebirth in being there. Now, about that commissioned score for 2001, when Kubrick directed Spartacus in 1960, he got a great score from Alex North, a composer who really helped move film composing into the modern era. So it made sense to hire North for another large-scale project, and that's what Kubrick did. At the same time, as filmmakers often do when putting together rough cuts of their movies, Kubrick cut some sequences together using pre-existing music as a way of getting a feel for the rhythm and the mood of a scene, and also you can then show that to the real composer and give him something to think about. Well, the funny thing was, Kubrick kind of fell in love with those temporary tracks, and he also felt, ultimately, that North's new score did not jibe with the visual experience on the screen, so he just scrapped that new score entirely and made the temporary permanent. It wasn't so funny for Alex North. Apparently, nobody told him about this until, by legend, the night he went to see the film for the first time. Kubrick would later say, "However good our best film composers may be, they are not a Beethoven, a Mozart, or a Brahms. Why use music which is less good when there is such a multitude of great orchestral music available from the past and from our own time?" Alex North's score was later recorded. You can listen to it if you want and be impressed by his work, while still concluding that Kubrick had done something remarkable with his decision. And here's an example of what's remarkable about listening to 2001. When the movie abruptly transitions from a time of prehistoric man-apes to a spaceship cruising through the galaxy, the music that springs up is a familiar classic, Johann Strauss II's most famous waltz, On the Beautiful Blue Danube, which we hear as Kubrick takes time to show us the meticulously made spacecraft and the futuristic thingamabobs of the 21st century. Instead of the music being a cliché because of its familiarity, you have this wonderful disparity between the 19th century sound and the sights of the future. Both of them tokens of mankind's ingenuity, even if the film itself questions whether we've progressed all that far from prehistoric times. And somehow a Strauss waltz takes on the weightless trajectory of a spaceship as we listen to the Blue Danube. Johann Strauss Jr.'s The Blue Danube, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic there under the direction of Carl Boehm for the 2001 soundtrack. I got to know the score of that film when my dad bought a new stereo system at some big Seattle department store way back when. And at that time, they'd give you a couple of free LPs when you bought a new stereo. And one of the ones my dad brought home was a soundtrack to 2001. Pretty good freebie. I'm Robert Horton. You're listening to The Music and the Movies, and we are considering some of the classical music picked by Stanley Kubrick for his films. You might remember that A Clockwork Orange, made in 1971, includes some curious devotion on the part of its brutish protagonist toward the music of the great Ludwig van, as Malcolm McDowell's character Alex calls Beethoven. Kubrick used a lot of classical music in this film almost as a way of measuring how degraded culture had become. And sometimes he had the electronic music pioneer Wendy Carlos render a classical piece through synthesizers. We shared one of those on a previous show, the speeded-up, switched-on version of the William Tell Overture, which plays to great comic effect over a fast-motion sex scene in that movie. And this time, let's listen to the opening music in the film. This is Wendy Carlos's electronic take on The Funeral of Queen Mary, originally composed in 1695 by Henry Purcell, considerably altered for A Clockwork Orange. That is the march from the music for the funeral of Queen Mary, composed in the 17th century by Henry Purcell, but rendered electronically by Wendy Carlos, for the opening sequence of A Clockwork Orange, when we first meet Alex and his droogs at their favorite milk bar. Despite his life of repugnant ultraviolence, Alex reveres Beethoven, and the Ninth Symphony plays a significant role in our anti-hero's trajectory. Here's just a 3-minute excerpt from the Ode to Joy, which might be used with a little irony on Kubrick's part.
Ein sanfter Flügel war, ein Zauber.
Well, you know that music from the fourth movement of the Ninth Symphony by Beethoven, performed there by the Philadelphia Orchestra and the Westminster Choir. Piece of classic music that figures prominently in A Clockwork Orange. Although in Stanley Kubrick's world, the Ode to Joy is probably to be taken ironically. For his next project, Kubrick would back away from the future and delve into the past with a 1975 adaptation of the Thackeray novel Barry Lyndon. The music is a mix of classical works and beautiful Irish songs by the Chieftains, all of which provide a melancholy accompaniment to the life of an ill-fated Irishman named Redmond Barry, played by Ryan O'Neill. A saraband by Handel forms a running theme, arranged for the film by Leonard Rosenman. Music by George Friedrich Handel, the saraband from his Suite for Harpsichord No. 4. It features prominently in Stanley Kubrick's film Barry Lyndon. You're listening to The Music of the Movies. I'm Robert Horton. We are playing classical music from Kubrick films, but here's a more sprightly cut from the Barry Lyndon soundtrack. This is the first of Schubert's five German dances. Music by Franz Schubert from his five German dances, heard in Stanley Kubrick's film Barry Lyndon, a film that might be Kubrick's best amidst some strong competition. Kubrick wanted to stick to music from the film's exact period, but when he found 18th century music insufficiently dramatic and romantic, he changed his boundaries. And one example is the following piece. It's more Schubert, the piano trio in E flat. Kubrick said, "I think I must have listened to every LP you can buy of 18th century music. One of the problems which soon became apparent is that there are no tragic love themes in 18th century music." So he opted for this piece, written in 1828, which he said has just the right restrained balance between the tragic and the romantic without getting into the headier stuff of later romanticism. Thank you. Piano Trio in E-flat by Franz Schubert, which serves as a romantic melody in Stanley Kubrick's Barry Lyndon, although most of the romance in the film is chilled by Kubrick's baleful view of human aspiration. And for the horror of his next film, The Shining, 1980, Kubrick once again used pre-existing music, including work from Krzysztof Penderecki and some very eerie Bartok, but he also went back to Wendy Carlos for a memorable electronic opening theme, based on the traditional Requiem melody, Dies Irae. You can picture Jack Nicholson heading for the Overlook Hotel as this ominous music plays.
Yeah.
Music by Wendy Carlos in collaboration with Rachel Elkind. That is the opening theme from The Shining. You're listening to The Music and the Movies. I'm Robert Horton. We are listening to the way classical music operates in Stanley Kubrick's films. Well, Kubrick would not go classical for his next movie, Full Metal Jacket, which used pop songs to decorate its Vietnam story. But he did go through his record library again for his final film, Eyes Wide Shut, 1999, the haunted story of a complacent doctor, played by Tom Cruise, who gets thrown into a dark night of the soul. I think it's interesting that Kubrick chose a waltz for his main theme here. Kind of connects the story back to its literary origins. It's based on a novella by Arthur Schnitzler, set in the Vienna that wasn't that far from Strauss and the Blue Danube Waltz. And when you think of how often the movements in Kubrick's films, and he did love a moving camera, describe a kind of dance, whether we're talking about the spaceships in flight or those two generals waltzing a dance of mutual seduction, which will have barbaric consequences in Paths of Glory, or the circular movements around the Overlook Hotel lobby in The Shining. Eyes Wide Shut is another waltz, albeit a dark one, in which our hero discovers the dangers of a bigger system that he's unaware of, and the dangers of his own imagination. The waltz Kubrick chose is by Dmitri Shostakovich, the waltz number 2 from the Suite for Variety Orchestra. Thank you. That is the Waltz No. 2 from Shostakovich's Suite for Variety Orchestra, performed by the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra, a number used to set the mood in Stanley Kubrick's final film, Eyes Wide Shut. That has a very civilized, very elegant European feeling to it, and I think that works well for a story about how easily the civilized surface can crack and reveal an abyss beneath. Well, speaking of cracking and revealing the abyss, that's the trailer music. And our offbeat choice here is also from Eyes Wide Shut. It's actually something by a contemporary British composer named Jocelyn Pook. It's spelled Pook, but I guess it's pronounced like book. So Jocelyn Pook is what we're going to go with. She's composed a few different items for Eyes Wide Shut, including a big, scary piece called Masked Ball, which accompanies Tom Cruise as he sneaks into an elegant orgy staged by the hidden society that secretly runs everything. The scene is chilling and eerie and maybe just slightly intentionally absurd. Very Kubrick. Pook took a recording of chanting Romanian priests and played it backwards for part of the effect of the masked ball sequence, and the result is real nightmare fuel.
Stop, 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 stop Buon futuro. Io si fine giù e tu morta si. Buon futuro. Io si fine giù e tu morta si.
That is music from Eyes Wide Shut, composed by Jocelyn Pook, a piece called Masked Ball, which sets just the right outlandish and creepy tone for the film's long day's journey into night. Well, as you have heard, Stanley Kubrick's taste in classical music was hardly one note. He found things to serve the purpose of the particular film, and he certainly proved that using something old could be a way of creating something utterly new, and creating something utterly new was what Kubrick did every time he made a film. One composer we haven't mentioned yet is Gyorgy Ligeti, but Kubrick used the Hungarian composer's very modern-sounding work repeatedly in 2001, a little bit in The Shining, and also in Eyes Wide Shut. You are hearing music from the latter, a piano work composed in the early 1950s. It's called Musica Rizzicata. This is the second movement performed by Dominic Harlan, a sinister little figure that underscores the sense of a world out of joint. And that was the world Stanley Kubrick saw with his sardonic and unsparing eye, with classical music to either provide ironic counterpoint or fretful accompaniment. I'm Robert Horton. I thank you for listening to The Music and the Movies.